The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
If it's shown in its ugliness, it's true. A film that I found wanting, just to give an example, is the film that probably many of you have seen, Barbara Streisand's The Way We Were. It begins, left-wing girl, right-wing boy, they meet each other, they fall in love with each other, but it's difficult, they have such different understandings and lifestyles. He is a writer, she becomes his conscience, as it were, and they do marry. Well, people who marry, left-wing, right-wing, that's difficult. And the film shows us the difficulties, and it works, and it's fine, it's fantastic. They go to Hollywood, and he becomes a very famous filmmaker and so on. Up till that point, the film is fine, and I can be with it. I would say that's beautiful. But at a certain moment, the man compromises, and that can happen. That's wrong, that's bad, that's ugly, he shouldn't have compromised, but he did. That's human. But now the problem, how do we solve it? Well, as a kind of very trite symbol, now I begin to talk negatively, you hear, as a very trite and superficial symbol, in the film, they only found this solution that now the marriage had to be broken and there was divorce. So at the very moment that the baby is born, the same day the man leaves, that is, a scene where you see the man taking leave of his wife. And I felt that scene and everything that goes on in the film later, because the next shot is that you see her 10 years later, still as a left-wing girl, walking around with band, the bomb, protest marching and so on, and you see him going into Hilton with a beautiful woman taking a fantastic dinner. That's a right-wing attitude to life. Okay, well, this duality. And I would say at the moment of that divorce, the film becomes totally a lie. And I think it's bad propaganda because it makes people think that you can go out of each other that easily, that you can have a divorce that easily. Because I know, and out of my own life experience, that it doesn't work. In La Brie, we have these people, and so would know if these people really divorce, the man will never write a book anymore in his life. And the woman will be, let's say, come to La Brie, and we will have a hard, hard time, maybe half a year, just to bring her back to normalcy and make her human again. It doesn't work like this. It's a lie. And it's a lie because it's against reality. And I think the wrongness of the film is that it doesn't show that. It makes something in a very sweet, and I would say very sentimental ending, where it could have been strong and real. Yes? No, it doesn't, because it says that divorce is wrong, because the woman is inspiration to the man, he shouldn't break that. That's what the picture is about. It talks about strong married relationships. No, it doesn't suggest rape. It uses the metaphor of rape for woman. It's only a metaphor. It's not a story about rape. The other picture was rape, in the bad sense. This is just a metaphor of rape. But it is not true rape. Rubens never said, if you rape a woman, it's beautiful. Rubens would have said, that's ugly. But the marriage situation, that's fantastic. Because now the woman becomes inspiration to the man. And if anybody in the world could say that, it's Rubens himself. Because he was twice married and both times very happy. And he has depicted his wives also in the nude because they were his inspiration. Also in the bodily sense. But in a much deeper sense too. And so you just misunderstand the word rape in the rape of the Brothers of Leucippus, because it's just a trite little title that brings you into deep realities. He uses it as a metaphor, but we shouldn't lay any stress on rape here, because that's not the point. And of course, that's not the point in many other 17th century pictures. It's always the strong relationship of man-woman. Rape in the sense of rape in the low sense, you find in that picture that I showed by Rubens, that etching of the wife of Potiphar. There you have the sheer sex and all its uglinesses. So it makes a difference.
Yeah,
I hope you begin to understand. Think about it.
So the picture that you contrasted the Rufus with, there was another great, equally a Christian picture, because it showed the ugliness of race and all of ugliness.
No. It just tried to, well, it was such a low and bad picture. I think it really tore it down. It did two things. It tore down the Rubens. It looked at the Rubens as, let's say, a very superficial-looking Christian-American look at that picture and say, well, that's a bad rape. And I think that's not the case. You just tear something down that's beautiful, and I think I hate it for that reason. It's a kind of comment on that painting. And secondly, it makes it so ugly. But it didn't show the uglinesses of the rape. If it had done that, okay. But it was just a bad picture. I can't see it another way. And I think nobody will see that in another way. I'm sorry. Yes?
But the problem that I think is being bandied about here is that your ability to understand the stories, your analytical approach to art, precludes a certain knowledge of all that's implicit in those pieces
no.
of art.
No, sorry.
When we just come to any piece of art without that precludes.
No, sorry. Of course, I said you see what you know, right? I said that's where it began and where it will end. You see what you know. And of course, your knowledge is implied. But it's not true. This is a wrong conclusion out of a right definition. If you look at the Rubens, and that's the greatness of 17th century art. I'm not saying that there's no criticism to be made on Rubens. I can make my criticism, but I think we should begin with giving honor due to where honor is due, and this is one of the greatest artists in the world, and he was a man who had, at least at this point, very deep understanding, and he was able to bring it forward very beautifully. So let's give him honor. And let's not begin with criticism, but end with it very softly in this case. So Rubens, and it's true of all 17th century art, also the Dutch art, this art works in layers. So what you see, if you're walking in a palace and you have such a Rubens hanging on the wall, it's a very beautiful ornament. It's fantastic colors, and that's what it is. You can pass it by like that, and it's beautiful. But now you stand still and you begin to look at it, and what you see first is movement, fantastically painted women and men. That is the next layer. Then you begin to ask the story, and the story has very complex implications. Indeed, if I want to make you really truly understand the meaning of subject matter in 17th century art, I try to do that in my scheme with motifs and themes. You see, it is not a little story. The story is used for a motive. Well, then we listen to the story and we think a little bit through what are the implications and why it's used. And then we go on to the through motive. And then through motive we can go deeper and deeper. And in a way, these paintings have, in the end you end with a universal, that love is so important. You see, and if I see that all together, then I really begin to say, well, this is one of the greatest works of art, which I think it is, incidentally. Now, I understand that if you come for the first time to Munich and you stand in front of that painting, you are not able to talk like I am doing if I stand in front of that painting, but that's obvious. I'm a professor in the history of art and you are not. But that does not mean that I see things that you do not see, because the moment I see things that you do not see, there must be something wrong. And there can be something wrong, and I think, may I just make a metaphor here. I gave the lecture I gave you on Thursday night half a year ago in Calgary. I'm sorry, I got to name names. I gave the lecture in Calgary. When I was giving the lecture, some people went away during the lecture. And the next days, many people came up to me and they said, are these nudes not obscene, and is that not pornography, and so on. Well, I must say, when the first person comes to you, say, oh, maybe I've overrated my audience, maybe I'd made a mistake, maybe I didn't make myself clear. Of course, these people are not accustomed to this type of things. After all, they live in Calgary, somewhere in the backwoods of the world. So, but I must say, as people went on asking me, that after a day, I felt very worried. And I was really worried. So we had a discussion two evenings later, and I sat on my little table, and I said, I'm so worried. What is the worry? 2 evenings ago, I was giving a lecture in Park Street Church. It is the same lecture I gave you at Calgary Church about God's will, God's salvation, man's calling. When I finished my lecture, somebody said to me, you are an art historian, aren't you? You know something about art. I have a question about it. Well, he had a good question, and we talked about it. Then somebody in the back in the room said, may I have a question? And of course, he could have a question. He said, well, if an artist, if a Christian is an artist and he goes to an art school, well, what about it? He has to paint nudes and so on and so on. And I feel that it's totally out of context. And I'm worried. I'm really worried. Deep down inside, I'm worried. What is happening here? Are you not living, people? You see, it's something like this. You are going to to found a new bank. You see, but do you have to have a bank? You got to have money, you got to have a building, you got to have personal. Of course, you got, and that's a prerequisite to have understanding of banking problems and money problems. Okay, well, if you will go around and say you're worrying all the time where you're going to buy your paper, I'm saying you're a fool. You shouldn't make a building, and you shouldn't make a bank because you're thinking about two little things. Well, that's a relationship. If we talk about art, we don't talk about nudity. It's such a little thing in relationship to the big things. Well, I know nudes and humanity. Why is it such a loaded thing? Not because the nude is so loaded, but because humanity is so loaded, because reality is so loaded. And it's good to think about it, but we shouldn't make it too strong. And I'm really worried if in America people always talk about it. I think it's completely out of context. It's a little thing, and it's not a big thing. It's so beautiful. And if I look to the Rubens and anybody wants to drag it down and say that it is, well, pornography or anything, I really feel, and that's inside in my body, I really feel to slash that person and say, you don't know what you're talking about. You're debasing the world. You say that something that's beautiful is ugly. You're raping women. That's a rape. To rape the beauty of that woman in that painting and to say that she's ugly or that she is a whore or anything like that. You see, that debases things. And I'm worried about America. And I'm worried about Christianity. Why are we talking about? Is that the small legalism? Is that the sentimentality that we're talking about? It's a good question. Is a sunset sentimental? Yes, if there's not a strong reality behind it, where men are men and women are women, and where we are together, also having bodies. Otherwise, we are no bodies. And I feel that the questions that I was so worried about in Calgary and the gentleman there down in Boston with his question, I'm so worried about these people because I'm afraid that they are no bodies. They don't have bodies. They don't live. They are dead people. And one of these days, in my last lecture, I will phrase to you the question of a hippie question. And I think it's one of the most forceful questions that we can answer. And we have to answer it. And we Christians have the answer. And we got to give the answer. No, we got to live the answer. The question is there a life before death? Is there a life before death? Well, I think if I hear to these questions, and I'm not blaming anybody, but I'm getting emotional, yes? Because I think it's so important, the things we're talking about. It's so loaded. Yes, if we live, then these things belong to it. And anybody who drags down the Rubens rapes life itself. And I can't see that anywhere else. Now, of course, I understand that gentleman's question there, and he's right. You know, have more seen more than we do. And I would say, yes, but maybe you were raised in a wrong framework, and I'm challenging that framework. The legalistic, small fundamentalism, to which the artist is not to become modern and jump out in the world and become worldly, but the answer is to get back to Scripture, because Scripture doesn't talk like that. And in Scripture you have, let's say, people in the past, very, very, very wrong, deeply wrong, shamefully wrong, said the Song of Songs can never talk about the relationship of men and women. You see, it is a kind of metaphor of Christ and the church. Well, of course, the Bible is full of this. The relationship of Christ and the church, Christ and the Christian community, is of the bride and the groom. And as far as that's true, of course, the Song of Songs is also talking about Christ and the church. But it, in the first place, talks about relationship of men and women. And we barely dare to read it on the tables to our children, because it's so strong with all the beauties of life. But we can't talk about it. God says, where is it in Ezekiel? I found you lying naked in the wilderness, and you were bathing in your blood. You was a newborn baby, and I bathed you, and I raised you, and then you got beautiful, and your breasts were like towers, and so on. That's the way God and the Bible speaks about it. And it doesn't take these things away and means like as if these things are shameful. No, the Bible talks about it so beautiful. And why do we try to rape the Bible and take these things out of it? I can't see your point, because, and then I got to say with this gentleman, we got to understand 17th century imagery, 17th century symbols, because the expression that he has is one of happiness. It's even contrary to the whole story. That is the kind of tension that there is in the picture. But I really think it goes too far to deal with that now at length and in depth. I think that 17th century vision on women was not one that says, well, let's say that the women lived today would take, but it had a high regard for women. And if you look at Rubens, not just at one picture, but all his work, and if you look at what Rembrandt has done and many other painters, I would say that the 17th century does show a very high regard for women, not as sex objects, that is 20th century, but really in the fullness of a human being, a side of man. And they did it.
I don't see where a high regard for women is shown.
Because the woman is the inspiration to the man, what's more? And it's not her body, in only body sense, because then we get in this playboy kind of thing. It's not the playgirl that inspires the playboy to be horny, but it is the woman in the fullness of her womanhood that inspires the man to be a real man and do great deeds in the world. And it can only be done if they live together in a very close relationship, because the strongest unit in the world is marriage, where both become full man and full woman. And that's what Rubin is talking about. And it's so clear in all his other pictures, and it's so clear if you read the 17th century, what people were writing about marriage. I think they had a very better, much better view about than many people have around us in maybe the Christian circles. So don't try to read, if I understand you well, if I may be a little bit naughty at this moment, don't try to begin to protest in the sense of women lip against the 17th century. I think you're wrong if you do so. It's not true. It's not there. I think that 17th century things were much more healthy. Of course, there were many bad men, and there were many bad women in the 17th century, and the times were not perfect, I know. But I think their ideals were much better than ours, and much less sentimental, by the way. Yes? Oh, yes. May I just say, I wish that Christian artists would do it.
Well,
I'm long... No, not in that way, because that's not that picture. But then it should be another picture, and it should be different. But that's what I'm longing for. And we got always to do two things, that is to show the ugliness as ugly and to build up the beauty as beauty. And if we don't do the two at the same time, as it were, we always find wanting, because otherwise beauty becomes sentimental, or we become Gnostic in saying the world is bad. But they got to be both. just like I was saying in another lecture, maybe I've said it already here, or maybe I'm going to say it, I've forgotten at this moment, that there's always a tension that in the acceptance of the world, even of man being sinful, I simply got to accept that we live in a sinful world. And I got to accept that we all die. But at the same time, I'm not accepting it, and I'm a protester, and I say, I don't accept sin, I don't accept corruption. In a way, I don't accept death. Well, where is the Christian's place? Well, exactly, because Christ was standing there and said, I don't accept. And we follow him, and this is the tension in which we live, because we know, not yet, but yet never, the less, we cannot accept. You see, so this attention of the acceptance and no acceptance. Well, both got to be shown, and probably we got to show it in the tension. To start where we ended last morning, the question of nudity. I've been thinking about it again and discussing a little bit. One question is, why are people, particularly evangelicals or fundamentalistic people in America, so very tight about this? And somebody gave me a very interesting answer when I discussed that. He said, it is because they have always used that little tag to avoid talking about art. You see, just if somebody begins to talk about art, and the very first thing is, oh yes, but then you got to go to a college and draw nudes, and that's no good. So then you can just say and stop it and don't think about it anymore. So you take the smallest little entity to fight the bigger thing possible. And I think as interest is growing, and there are so many young Christian artists, which is a very new situation for which I'm very happy, just as an aside, I think it's so important that artists are there. It is not the fulfillment of my prayers and a fulfillment of my dreams, but I think it's very, very important, not just because art is nice, or one of the terms I really hate is you enjoy art, and that makes you into a kind of hedonist to be an art historian, and I'm not, although I love life and I love art and I enjoy it. But that's not the point. The point is that there will never be a real reformation without the arts, because the arts bring it to us. We talked about it yesterday a little bit. But so it's good to get this kind of question out of the way. Why do people are so tight about it? And so we shouldn't pin in into that little question to avoid the big questions. Nevertheless, there are questions, I'm not denying that. And I think one point that I don't know about all of you, but Americans at large, or maybe I would say 20th century people at large, are weak in, and that's an historical understanding. Although history is very much in our age, nevertheless, you sometimes feel that the understanding of history is getting less and less. And we got to look at these things historically. I remember many years ago I had an audience of nice American girls, where were they coming from some university, and I don't know how we got into that question, that's too long ago, I don't remember. But I said, you must understand, as you're all sitting here very nicely dressed, that you were very immoral if you happened to be in Bali. Because in Bali, women, of course, walk with their upper part of their body uncovered, but to show your ankles, that's really obscenity, you see? So it is, there's quite a bit of cultural customs and ways of life into this, and we should be very careful to judge it. If people, let's say in Japan, bath in the nude together, that doesn't mean that these are obscene or immoral people. It only means that they have a different approach or a different ways of doing things. And we must look at it. Just a little bit of the history of this. In Europe, the attitude to nudity has always been, since Christianity came, kind of, how do you call that, ambiguous. Sometimes they said yes, sometimes they said no. And it is just in our own days that I find it very strange indeed. Let's say, if I go with my students on excursion, it's impossible that boys sleep in the same room as girls. And everybody would think it's very strange if that would happen. You don't do that. But at the same time, these same boys and girls read things and look at things that in a previous age, and the previous age is 10 years ago, nobody would have accepted to look at, and they would have considered wrong. So I think there's a kind of strange tension in our world that things are acceptable which are not acceptable, and they are not acceptable which are acceptable. And that's very strange. And I think this is something very wrong. But let's go into history. In the 16th and 17th century, although there was something of that ambiguity, nevertheless, as a whole, there was a much more healthy approach to these things than they are today. People were not prudish. It's a very interesting little story that I want to mention. In the middle of the 17th century, during the time of Cromwell, really, there was an Englishman who was traveling in Holland, and he kept a diary. And he tells us how he went to Delft, and well, he tells us about his experiences. Now, one little in between, what he was talking about was not something extraordinary, but was something very normal. That was how things went in those days. So you went to sleep in an inn. Now, an inn was a hotel. If you came there, you said, "Do you have a bed for me?" And they would say yes. And then they would, of course, you would eat or drink something there, and then they would usher you to the sleeping hall. There were no little rooms. There was one or two big rooms in which there were many beds, just like a very large dormitory. And in those beds, there would be sleeping women, men, and couples. And as the sleeping fashion was nothing, they didn't have any pajamas in those days. Everybody would undress, which is the most natural thing in the world, if you go to sleep, because that's the way you go to sleep. And nobody thought anything about it. That was the most natural thing. So this Englishman, he describes how he woke up in the morning, and he saw a lovely lady wake up and rise, and he said, and I looked how she dressed, because it's such an interesting thing, this Dutch fashion. It's so different, and it's wonderful. And later on, he says how he even didn't dare to kiss the hand of that lady because she was, because too beautiful and something that you didn't touch. You see, so they have, in a way, both things. There were some moralistic writers in the 18th century that wrote something like this, that you see, in those days, the beds were in the living room. You see, in Holland you had those beds which were in the walls, and you had them in many European countries, but the bed was in the living room. So let's say you have a gathering in the evening, and the daughter of the house says, well, it's time for me to go to bed, tomorrow I have to wake up early, and you gentlemen, you just talk on, and she would go to bed. You see, and that would happen in the room. And so, and one of these moralistic writers said, well, it's better not to uncover your breast and the rest of it in the presence of all these gentlemen. But that was a very soft advice. There was nothing wrong about it. That changed in the middle of the 18th century. And it's very interesting. It's one of these very difficult passages in history. I forgot the date, but there was a medicine man, a medical doctor in Lausanne, who published a little book, let's say somewhere around 1730 or 40, talking about masturbation, and that masturbation is causing sicknesses. That's completely out of the air, but everybody believed him. And that began all the things that have been talked about since, start from that little book. And you see that very soon things began to change, and people considered lust to be something sinful or bad or ugly, something you couldn't do. And it's very interesting. In Holland, somebody made a very extensive study of this, a very interesting book. He went into all the details of this. What I'm doing is more or less relating what he's talking about. And he came to, this man is not a Christian. He came to the conclusion that, and he gives almost a precise date, somewhere in the middle of the 18th century, that it changed. And it changed in the humanistic circles. Humanism brought the change. And then this man, not being a Christian, makes clear that about 10 to 15 years later, the Christians followed, which to me is a tragic moment in history. Why did the humanist had such a negative attitude towards lust and, let's say, the bodiliness? And, well, I can describe it just by making it a little bit visual. Think about the Duke of, and just give him a name. The Duke is reading in his library, he's reading the latest thing, the Encyclopedia coming from France. He's very well educated, he reads French. And so he reads Diderot, and he reads his encyclopedia. And in an encyclopedia, they find, what is man? You just read man, homme. And it says basically this, if you read that article, there is no difference between man and animals and plants and things. There is no difference. We are just like animals. Who said that you're so different? Of course, this was a very violent anti-Christian statement. It was meant to be like this. It was also something which was completely unproved. Of course, since that time, science has worked very hard to prove it, and today it has proved it, because basically man is an atom, and in long, long stretches of time, and I'm not going to follow all that, a man came as a kind of mistaken animal. It is just a mistake of evolution that we're in all the difficulties we are in, you know? Well, suppose, well, the Duke is reading that book and he says, wonderful what this man is saying. It's great, fantastic, convincing. An hour later, when he is finished reading, his wife, the Countess, comes in. And he has just been reading, there is no difference between man and animals and plants and things. So when the Countess comes in, basically, she is a female rabbit, and he is a rabbit. You see, they produce children. Well, there's no difference, you see. But it's a little bit difficult to look at the Countess, a very high person and so on, as a kind of rabbit, you see. So what do you do? Well, in order to accept the Diderot and the French Encyclopedia and all that went with it, you had to save your humanity. So in order to save your humanity, you got to push the animality of man, which is certainly we have, the animality of man out of the picture. And that's why people began so prudish. That's my explanation. They were just afraid of it. In the 19th century, we even went so far that little girls had a certain operation to take away a little piece of their body in order that they will never enjoy life, because sex was, lust was sinful, you see. So, and I think it went even that far. I'm not telling stories, it even went that far. And it's very strange. And of course, as a Christian, I would just reverse that, and I would say, just in the line of the trees that I was talking about yesterday, if God gives us a body, then of course it's very easy to explain why I have arms and hands. It's not difficult to explain why I have legs. It's not difficult to explain why I have a head and eyes and ears. You can find for everything a kind of utilitarian possibility. And I would say that explanation is too small, but nevertheless it is an explanation. But there are certain parts of the body that have no explanation. You see, the male sexual organs, of course, have a very set purpose for procreation. But exactly the female body, that little part that was taken away, is only there for lust. And if God gave that, then we are not going to say it's wrong. You see, and we got to understand that if God is giving something, we got to take it out of his hands and say thank you. And so I think it's really wrong if Christians followed the humanist. And the very interesting thing is that nowadays the humanists in the majority have turned away, and they have violently reacted to that repression of sin, sex, to an overindulgence in sex. But that the Christians, being afraid for the overindulgence, and that's good to be afraid of that, and not to go with it, but nevertheless, don't understand that it's now their time to say what is good. And of course, it's a very difficult thing to have a right balance. But I think these things are very important in our Christian communities. And to think about this, how do you raise your children? What do you teach them? We come to the third point that I want to raise in this respect, and that is that even if these things are right that I'm saying, then nevertheless that doesn't mean that we can do everything tomorrow. Not because they're right or wrong, but because there's so much emotion, so much of our whole being involved, particularly in these things, not because they're trite and superficial, just because they're so very deep and important. And that's why they go very deep into our being. And the way we were raised and the things that have been brought to us from our own background, they go so deep that it's very difficult sometimes to jump out. So if a young artist comes to me and he says, well, I'm on the academy, but I have difficulties in going to the life class, then my first reaction would be, why don't you try it? Because you will find out in 5 minutes that it's nothing what you think about. There's nothing to do with sex. But if you have difficulties, you must know that there's Christian freedom and there's nobody who's going to force you. And just like Paul says, if you cannot eat meat because the meat for you is contaminated, then you don't eat it because you cannot go against your conscience. And I would say there's something beautiful, and one of the most interesting passages in the Bible, I find, is somewhere in Hebrew, in one of the letters of John, where it's written that if your conscience is not against you, we would think, being very legalistic little people, that God knows better, and even if your conscience don't go against you, God goes against you, because nevertheless it's wrong. But the Bible exactly says this: if your conscience goes against you, God knows better, and so don't be afraid. And so in these points, if somebody comes to me and he says, I really can't do that, it's against my conscience, I would say, never force yourself. Because what we do, we eat and drink, do it into the honor of God. And don't force yourself. Don't eat, just like Paul in Romans, don't eat things that you think are wrong. Even if there's freedom, and these things shouldn't be forced upon somebody else. So we should find a balance here in Christian freedom also not to do things, even if they are maybe wrongly put like that. But in a group like this, I would stress that we should really think these things through. And if we personally cannot do certain things, walk without clothes on the beach, well, then we shouldn't do it. And we shouldn't force ourselves to be with it, because that's phony. And basically, maybe it's even sinful. But that doesn't mean that everybody who does so is sinful and wrong, because we got to think these issues through. Certainly if we are supposed, as most of you are supposed, to be Christian leaders in the future, because you've got to teach people something. These were just a little few notes on the problem that we had yesterday, just to show you that I've been thinking a little bit about it. Now, we go into another problem, a very important problem. The problem was posed to me in different ways, about the use of modern art forms. Can we as Christians use modern art forms? You can expand that question in many ways. And I think that we cannot answer that question in this way. First, we got to say, what are we talking about? And so that's one of the reasons why I made that lecture that I gave last week on the difference between 20th century art forms and modern art forms. So I would say it's impossible for every Christian, whosoever he is, to be modern, because to be modern is to follow a certain sect which is a totally and very deeply anti-Christian sect. So you cannot be an anti-Christian Christian. That's silly. So can you be modern? I would say no, of course you cannot be modern. But you can be contemporary. And of course it's even impossible not to use 20th century form. So the whole question is, can I use modern art forms? That to me is a strange question, because it means, can I speak English? But then modern is used in the sense of 20th century and not in that specific and more narrow sense of that specific school. If a Christian comes up to me, can I be an existentialist? I would say, no, that's easy. But can I be a philosopher? Of course. And you cannot avoid being a philosopher if you think. You see? And so we got to differentiate in the problems. Styles and forms are not neutral. They are vehicles of content. And some can and some can't be used. Yes, of course, forms carry content. And of course, we must be very careful, not only in art forms, but also in language forms. And there are certain things that people do use around you that you are careful maybe not to use, or if you use it, to change. Basically, it's something like this. I'm deviating from my little paper, but never mind. It's something that's very much on my mind. If this is the cultural forms of today, man's way of thinking and acting. This is, of course, a reduction of a reduction. It's a scheme of a scheme of a scheme. I know it's very simplified. But if this is the framework of our time, then as a Christian, you cannot avoid but being, living in our times, live in that same structure. You use the same cars, you use the same food, you use the same language, you read the same papers, you look at the same television, you go to the same places, you have the same kind of vacation. In college and school, 3/4 of the books are the same books. You cannot avoid living in that same structure. Nevertheless, there are many things in that structure that you don't like. And I think that exactly the most important point is the difference. So I think that if you are living in that structure, you try to change it. You try to get rid of that which you don't like, and you want to add what you miss. So it basically comes like this, that you are, I hope, something like this. That means there's a little bit that you've taken away, and it's a little bit that you've added to it. And I would say that's exactly the point. That's exactly what we're fighting for. That little difference, because that's all the difference. Interestingly, a good friend of mine said he once taught a course in an American college. He came from Holland. And he said, I taught about Augustine. And students were so interested in my talk, and they found it so different because I talked about the greatness of Augustine. But they, in that theological college, not this one, had been taught that Augustine was wrong. He was wrong here, he was wrong there, and of course he was wrong. But everything that he was wrong in was, let's say, the big square, that was this part. That were all the mistakes of his day. But if you really want to talk about Augustine, it's this part that's the most important. And it's that part that's the most important, because that's Augustine, and that's his achievement. And the difference is what counts. And of course, people in their own time know the difference. A couple of years ago, how long is it ago? A little bit less than 10 years. The miniskirt was invented. Discovered. Invented, what do you say? To my amazement and displeasure, although I love miniskirts, I think it's beautiful, if the girl is beautiful enough to wear it, we must add that. But to my displeasure, Christian girls immediately followed it, and I think they went too quick. And I think that this miniskirt was a real expression of a certain way of life. Even the people who were very much in that, evenly, even said that with so many words. The miniskirt stands as a symbol for that the woman is more easily available. That's what it means. Well, I think that Christians should have been thinking about it. And now don't take this in a moralistic sense or don't take this in a legalistic sense, but I think that a Christian girl should just have skirts 1/2 inch longer. And I think that's exactly the difference. You see, just the way you do these things. Of course, you cannot expect in a world where everybody wears miniskirts.